Today's lesson, or verse, be John 6, 10 to 14. John 6, 10 to 14. And Jesus said, "Make the people sit down, and there will be much grass in the place." So the men sat down in a number of 5,000. And Jesus took the loaves, and when he had given thanks, distributed them to the disciples, and the disciples to those sitting, and likewise of the fish, as much as they wanted. When they were filled, he said to the disciples, "Gather up the fragments and the remains, so that nothing is lost." Therefore he gathered them up. They filled 12 baskets with the fragments of 5 barley loaves, which were left over by those who have eaten. Then those men, when they had seen the sign that Jesus did, "This is truly the prophet. This is truly the prophet who has come into the world."
Morning. I want to second what Bill Path mentioned in his prayer about our gratefulness for all the work and laborers here at the congregation that have contributed to VBS. I thought we had a good week, and I think we did a lot of good. Of course, I wasn't one of the kids, so what do I know? But I think it went well, and I'm so grateful for the great variety of people that contributed in some way or another. I don't like to single people out, but if anybody gets a gold star, Debbie Witt Church did just a tremendous job putting it together this year and made things really easy. All summer long, if anybody asked me a question, I'd say, "I don't know, ask Debbie." And that was a response that worked for me for several months running. So that tells you how good a job she did. We appreciate you so much, Debbie. This morning, some of you know I like to plan out my sermons quite a bit in advance. So, for example, this year's sermon topics, with few adjustments, were planned out through the month of June anyway. By the time I got to January, I had about 6 months planned out. I like series. I like to do series for a couple of reasons. One, it lets our song leaders know where we're headed, and sometimes they appreciate that. It lets you know kind of what we're doing, but also it slows me down. If I try to not do a series, then I tend to want to put everything I know about a topic into one sermon, which means I have to talk really fast and talk for a long time, and you don't get as much out of that. So if I say, "Oh, that's okay, I can continue that next week," it tends to go a little better for me, so series work well. Well, I got all the way through to the month of June, and I had gone through the series I had planned for the year and realized I had run out of plans. And with new father brain, I also was not in a mood to make a lot of new plans. So what I've done for the next few months, I've defaulted to a very old preaching tradition known as the common lectionary. The lectionary is an old device used by the church historically that has a three-year rotation of passages, sermons preachers ought to preach on, and not a lot of folks use it anymore. It's kind of out of fashion, but I pulled it up the other day, and I said, "I need something to preach on for a while," and it said, "Preach on John 6," and so this morning, we're going to preach on John 6. The interesting thing about the lectionary that I thought was different than the way I normally approach a text, when I preach on John 6, I usually preach it all in one lump, because it all kind of goes together. The lectionary forces you to divide it up into about 5 pieces. So you have to slow down and kind of digest every little section of John chapter 6. So for the next 4 or 5 weeks, we're going to be in John chapter 6, and that'll give me some time to figure out what I'm going to do next, which will be exciting. But for now, I'd like to look at this text, which is a beautiful passage, and I think deserves our consideration. In John chapter 6, we're in the middle of John's book of signs. Some of the commentaries you might read on the book of John's gospel, will often say that the right way to divide up the book of John is to think of, say, chapter 2 through chapter 12 or so as its own book. And it's the book of signs. It's the book where John is telling you, here are 7 things that Jesus did that took our breath away and that showed us he was the Son of God. Now, the book ends in John chapter 20. The gospel ends when John points out that many other things did Jesus do that are not written in this book. Okay, so he acknowledges, I'm not trying to give you everything Jesus did. I'm trying to give you seven meaningful events in the life of Christ that drew our attention to him. So John chapter 6 is right in the middle of his seven sign list. Seven important things that Jesus did. It begins in the wedding of Cana in John chapter 2. It ends with the raising up of Lazarus midway through the gospel. So John chapter 6 is in the middle of that, which is usually the middle is kind of important. And so he really spends quite a lot of time in John chapter 6 talking about the sign of bread, the sign of Jesus feeding the thousands. We remember this as Jesus feeding the 5,000. It's recorded in the other gospel accounts. But John spends more time on it in more detail than anybody else because for him, it's one of these signs that tell us something about Jesus. It's important to know before you even look in John 6, though if you have your Bible, turn to John 6. We're going to be there for the whole lesson. It's important to know that this is not the first time you get a feeding people story in your Bible. In fact, they're fairly common when you think about it. That comes up in the Old Testament stories about great multitudes being fed at the hand of God. You might remember Moses in the wilderness and the manna from heaven. The story of manna is going to come up in John chapter 6, but I've got to save that till next week. But another story that comes to mind or might come to mind for you is Numbers chapter 11, 13 through 15. This is another one of those scenes in the wilderness where Moses and the people are out there and they're hungry. And hungry people are the nicest people, aren't they? No, hungry people are angry, bitter, complaining, grumbling people. In our house, we have our own word for it. We call it hanger. When you're hungry and angry at the same time, you have lots of hanger. And I have the worst case of hanger. You've seen the commercial where they say, give that guy a Snickers. That is modeled after my life. Celine knows Ben's in a bad mood. When did he eat last? It's worse than Calvin, actually. When did Ben eat last? So hanger is a real thing. Okay, so you got people out in the wilderness in Numbers chapter 11. They're all very hungry. They're all very grumpy. Thousands of Ben Williams is out there looking for a Snickers. And it's in this scene that Moses doesn't know what to do. He's kind of at a loss. He says to God, where am I to get meat to give to all this people? For they weep before me and say, give us meat that we may eat. And I am not able to carry all this people alone. The burden is too heavy for me. If you will treat me like this, kill me at once if I find favor in your sight that I may not see my wretchedness. This is not one of Moses' better days as a leader in Israel. How bad had things gotten? People were very, very hungry. And Moses says, I'm done with it. I'm finished. I can't deal with these hungry people. I don't have any food to give them. They want meat, and I haven't got any. God had provided manna. They weren't impressed. They wanted meat, and they start saying things like, let's go back to Egypt. We had meat in Egypt. And they start saying things like, we've always had it better. This is Moses' fault. As if Moses is in charge of all the food for Israel, apparently. But they thought he was, and they start complaining, and Moses can't take it. He says, this is a burden that is too heavy. The whole burden of feeding the entire people is on my shoulders, and I just can't carry it anymore. And he goes as far as to say to God, why don't you just strike me dead and take my life, and then you deal with the hungry people because I'm done. And I can't do it anymore. So this is just kind of one example of one of these feeding people stories in the Old Testament. You can keep reading Numbers and see what happens next, but I just wanted to give you kind of a taste of it as we go. Another scene, though, that I think is worth noticing is in the life of Elisha, the prophet. And in this particular story, let me see if I can get it to go. There it is, 2 Kings chapter 4, verses 42 through 44. Little different scenario, but it's a similar idea of people are hungry, what do we do about it? A man came from Baal Shalisha, bringing the man of God bread of the first fruits, 20 loaves of barley and fresh ears of grain in his sack. And Elisha said, give to the men that they may eat. But a servant said, how can I sit this before 100 men? So he repeated, give them to the men that they may eat, for thus says the Lord, they shall eat and have some left. So he set it before them, and they ate and had some left according to the word of the Lord. Now this one, if you're familiar with John chapter 6, this story sounds very familiar. You have people in a group around the prophet. They are hungry, and it's time to eat. And they have some loaves of barley bread, but not enough. Okay? So they bring the loaves to the prophet, and the prophet says, go ahead and feed them. The guy with the bread does the math and says, there's no way that's going to work. I don't want to explain to these people how little of each loaf they all get when we start dividing this up. There's no way it's going to work. The prophet simply repeats it, pass it out. And what is the promise? And you'll have some left over. And so, different but similar to the better known feeding of the 5,000, this is the feeding of the 100. Elisha feeds a small multitude in his own life with bread delivered by one of these individuals that's brought it to him. So when we come to John chapter 6, my point is these kinds of stories aren't entirely new. They would be familiar with a story like this when John tells this story. But what happens in John chapter 6 is so much bigger and more incredible than any of the stories of the Old Testament. It really starts to take our breath away. The passage gives us a setting in verses 1 through 4. After this, Jesus went away to the other side of the Sea of Galilee, which is the Sea of Tiberias. And a large crowd was following him because they saw all the signs that he was doing on the sick. Jesus went up on the mountain, and there he sat down with his disciples. Now the Passover, the feast of the Jews, was at hand. So the setting is, this is, again, in the middle of the story. This is John 6. And there's a story that runs from about chapter 2 to chapter 12. So this is the middle of the big story of wonderful things Jesus is doing. He is immensely popular. And so there is a huge crowd following him from one side of the sea to the other. And they're all waiting for him to see more of these signs, of which John has only given us three up to this point. But he tells us that Jesus has done a lot more than he cares to write down. And so they come, and on this occasion, it's the Feast of Passover. If you're reading John's Gospel, this is another clue that something important is about to happen. There are three Passovers in the Gospel of John. The first one is in John chapter 2, when Jesus goes into the temple and cleanses it and throws out the money changers. The second one is this one in John chapter 6. The third one is the crucifixion. So Passovers in John's Gospel are always a hint something exciting is about to happen. This time, though, he's not in Jerusalem. He's out in the wilderness, and all of these people happen to be there. Interesting that Passover itself is associated with bread and with a precise kind of meal that goes with it. So this story about a meal is all wrapped up and prepared by the setting. The story is pretty straightforward in verses 5 through 6. Lifting up his eyes then, and seeing that a large crowd was coming toward him, Jesus said to Philip, "Where are we to buy bread so that these people may eat?" He said this to test him, for he himself knew what he would do. Already we're getting a distinction between that story we read in the book of Numbers. Numbers has a hungry crowd of people, and Moses looks at them and he knows they're hungry, and he has no idea what to do. He asks God, how are we going to feed all these people? We can't feed all these people. Kill me now and somebody else feed all these people. Okay, Moses is a little bit upset. But Jesus is in the exact opposite situation. He is here asking the question, not looking for answers. He has the answer. He wants to know if anybody else is going to figure it out. And so he puts Philip to the test. Poor Philip. I wouldn't have passed either. I wouldn't have done any better than Philip. If you look, give me a big crowd of people and say, you know, how are we going to feed them? My first question is going to be, well, I've got my lunch. I don't know if they get anything or not. But Philip looks at all of them and he says, you know, I don't know how we're going to do this. But Jesus looks and he has a plan and a prepared answer for this particular occasion. In verses 10 through 13, Jesus said, let's start in verse 8 and following. We're going to skip over 8 and 9, but I want to read it just for the moment. We're going to come back to it because I've got more I want to say about it, but just have the story together. Verse 7, Philip answered, 200 denarii would not buy enough bread for each of them to get a little. One of his disciples, Andrew, Simon Peter's brother, said to him, well, there is a boy here who has 5 barley loaves and 2 fish, but what are they for so many? Jesus said, have the people sit down. Now there was much grass in the place, so the men sat down, about 5,000 in number. Jesus then took the loaves, and when he had given thanks, he distributed them to those who were seated, so also the fish, as much as they wanted. And when they had eaten their fill, he told his disciples, gather up the leftover fragments, that nothing may be lost. So they gathered them up and filled 12 baskets with fragments from the 5 barley loaves left by those who had eaten. Well, this story, of course, is incredible on every sense of it. Elisha's miracle was impressive. I mean, had you never read this story, you'd say that Elisha fellow was a great guy. He fed 100 people with just a few loaves of bread. But then Jesus pulls this number, and we look at it, and we can't even fathom the details of how it would work out. You've got 5,000 men, right? The text is actually specific. It doesn't use, this is not 500 or 5,000 humans. This is 5,000 males. I don't know how many kids were there. I don't know how many women were there. This is 5,000 adult males, and they're hungry. So there's at least 5,000 of them. They're hungry, and we've got just a handful of food, a little bit of bread and a little fish to go with it. In the ancient world, sometimes they do different things with fish and kind of use it as a relish that might go with the bread. But the bread was the staple of the meal. And that's where everyone's concerned. How are we going to feed these people with this much bread? It can't be done. Elisha fed 100 people. Jesus is going to feed 5,000. And not only is he going to feed them, but just like in the story of Elisha, there's going to be some left over. Enough so that we need to go gather it up so that nothing may be lost. Each of the disciples carries their own basket. So what we see in the story is this incredible example of where Jesus is doing something greater than people had ever imagined. Jesus is the true and better Moses. Moses once had fed the people, but he had no idea how it was going to work out. He turns to God and says, please do something because I'm at wit's end. Take my life or do something. He's at a loss. Jesus isn't at a loss. He knows exactly what he's doing. Jesus is the true and better Elisha. Feeding 100 is impressive. 5,000 is unheard of. And so in this scene, in a very straightforward miracle, John is trying to tell us something bigger about Jesus than he said up to now. That Jesus is like your favorite Old Testament hero, but he is bigger in every sense than you possibly could have imagined. He's more sure and more confident in what he's doing than Moses. He's more capable and giver of greater blessings than even was Elisha. However, the text doesn't stop there because it asks the question, who does this make Jesus to be? All of the signs in John's gospel are trying to tell you something about who Jesus is. Not just what he is, not just what he did. Let me make a side comment. A good biography tells you what a person did. A gospel tells you who a person is. And these are gospel stories. They are telling us something about Jesus, his person and his character, something about the God he represents in a powerful way. And so the story moves into its next phase, and the people start to wonder, who could this be? Well, they get the first part right. They knew their Old Testament better than we did. They didn't have to have those slides at the beginning of the sermon saying, do you remember Moses? Do you remember Elijah? They know these stories, and so their first conclusion is, this is that prophet. If you read verses 14, then the people saw the sign that had been done. They said, this indeed is the prophet who has come into the world. This is a prophet thing to do. This is a Moses thing to do. This is an Elisha thing to do. This is an incredible prophetic act. And so it tells us something about Jesus. He must at least be a prophet, maybe even the prophet. The book of Deuteronomy had promised that God would send a prophet like unto Moses. Well, maybe this is him. That prophet, that incredible figure that was to come. The next jump they make is, what if he's more than that? Because he seems more than that, doesn't he? His miracle is greater than Moses. His miracle is greater than Elisha. What if he is something more? And they look around, and I think we have to kind of understand the scene. You're in first century Jewish Palestine, right? You're under Roman rule. You're waiting for your Messiah to come, like unto David. And here we've got 5,000 people, 5,000 men, sitting out on the grass, being fed by this prophet. And somebody's mind goes where somebody's mind always goes. It starts to look like an army. If you could take these 5,000 men and give them bread, what chance would the Romans stand against this man? We've got a man who is miraculous in nature. We've got 5,000 people, men, ready to follow him wherever he leads. And so in verse 15, they come to the next conclusion. Perceiving then that they were about to come and take him by force to make him king, Jesus withdrew again to the mountain by himself. The people look at him and they make one more conclusion. Of course he's a prophet, but he's more than a prophet. This man is a king. This man is not just a voice of God in the midst of his people. This man is a leader of his people. This man is doing things that haven't been done. Moses was great. This man is greater. Elisha was great. This man is greater. Let's make him king. And so excited are they by the prospect of his kingship. Listen to the text. They are prepared to take him by force. By the way, that tells you more about Jesus than maybe anything else in this particular story. Other men try to become kings by force. Jesus is the sort of person who they have to make a king by force, and even then he says no. Right? He doesn't want that kind of crown that they were going to offer. They wanted someone to fight against the Romans. They want someone to give them a land and some freedom and liberty in this life, and that's what they were looking for. And he has no interest. And they're so passionate about it, they would compel him to do it. But he has no interest, and he goes apart by himself. So we get this question, who is Jesus? He's this man who makes bread. Well, obviously he's more than that. He's a prophet, but obviously he's more than that. He must be a king. Well, that's a good conclusion, but John isn't willing to stop there. If you were here Wednesday night, Bill Path gave us a lesson. I didn't get to hear it. I'm sure it was great. I was down with the children. But Bill gave us a lesson on the scene where Jesus walks on the water in the various gospel accounts. It's another one of those stories that's in several of the gospel accounts. And that's the next story that John wants to tell. In verses 16 through 21, he draws our attention even higher than the people were willing to look. The people said maybe he's a prophet. People said we could make him king, but John says what you're supposed to get out of this is the living God. When evening came, his disciples went down to the sea, got into a boat, and started across the sea to Capernaum. It was now dark, and Jesus had not yet come to them. The sea became rough, became as a strong wind was blowing, and when they had rowed about 3 or 4 miles, they saw Jesus walking on the sea and coming near the boat, and they were frightened. But he said to them, "It is I. Do not be afraid." Then they were glad to take him into the boat, and immediately the boat was at the land to which they were going. So many details in that short bit of story. And the reason John puts it there, I'm convinced, is to not allow you to come to the conclusion the people had just come to. Jesus feeds the 5,000. Okay, he's a prophet. Jesus feeds the 5,000. Okay, he's a king. John says you haven't looked high enough yet. And he follows with this story about Jesus out on the sea. And listen to the details of it. They're out on the sea, and we see Jesus out upon the water walking. Who walks on the water? You can ask the ancient pagans. Gods could walk on the waters. Gods made the waters. You could ask the Old Testament and give a much better answer. The God of Israel walks upon the waters, and he's the only one who can. Psalm 77, 16 through 19 reads like this. When the waters saw you, O God, when the waters saw you, they were afraid. Indeed, the deep trembled. The clouds poured out water. The skies gave forth thunder. Your arrows flashed on every side. The crash of your thunder was in the whirlwind. Your lightnings lighted up the world. The earth trembled and shook. Your way was through the sea, your path through the great waters. Yet your footprints were unseen. That's good stuff. What the psalmist is telling you there is this dramatic picture of God and how different he is from us. When a sailor is out on the ocean, the sailor is afraid of the storm. When God is on the ocean, the storm is afraid of God. God is the one who walks upon the sea. Unseen, perhaps, are his footprints, but the thunder and the lightning tell of his presence in this world. God walks upon the waters. Well, listen to that passage, and then the disciples look around, and there's Jesus doing it. Exactly as the psalm pointed out. There are the frightened sailors who think they're going to die. There's God walking upon the water, the only one who can. And what is their response? It says they were frightened. You'd better be. This is terrifying. This is a divine action. When God feeds 5,000, the people are amused. Maybe he'd make a good king. But when he walks on the water, John says, you didn't look high enough. You didn't see who he is really showing himself to be. He says, be not afraid, it is I. Bible translators are sometimes cowardly. There's a better way to translate this text. The Greek text, Nick, is ego eimi. Jesus says, be not afraid, I am. Be not afraid, I am, and invokes the very language that God of the Old Testament uses to describe himself. I am that I am. Be not afraid, I am. John says you're not looking high enough. Jesus says you're not looking high enough at who this person is. And then they invite him into the boat. Can I tell you how backwards that is from every other sailor story you've ever heard? Sailors are out on the sea. There's a man overboard. Save that guy. Get him into the boat. Not this day. There's a man overboard. Save us. Get him into the boat. Jesus is there to save the men on the ship. He's coming into the boat not for his benefit, but for theirs. John says you're not looking high enough. What I wonder about this story is if we don't do the same thing very often. We look at the incredible things that Jesus does in our lives, and we don't look high enough. We look for a Jesus who is convenient. We look for a Jesus who makes me feel better. He's a good therapist. He stands by my side and tells me, "You're a good guy, Ben." That's the kind of Jesus I'd like to have. But the Jesus the Bible presents us with is a lot higher than that, isn't he? He's there by my side, but he's also there above me. He's not just with me on the sea, he walks upon the sea. He doesn't just provide my food, he's the maker of all food. He is higher and greater. He's not just higher and greater than Moses and Elisha. He's the maker of Elisha and Moses. He is the great I am, and that's who we must recognize him to be in the sign of bread. In our everyday life, when we eat our meal, we've got to see that that's who God is. We've got to see the sign of bread. Too many of us are looking for the extraordinary. Now, if Jesus would walk on the water, I'd be impressed, right? Then I could believe in Jesus. But when God feeds me each and every day, I don't even bother to notice. We've got to learn to see the sign of bread and see the amazing thing that God has done, and don't cheat him out of it. Don't look at God as your grocer. Look at God as your creator and see who he is in all of these signs and who they revealed him to be. And then make the appropriate response to him. And now I do want to go back to verses 7 through 9. You remember how the story started? Jesus wants to feed the people. He says, "How are we going to feed them?" Philip does the math. Philip says it'd take 200 denarii. Denarii, by the way, is about a day's wage for a day laborer. It'd take 200 denarii, 200 days' wages, 40% of a laborer's annual income. And we could give everybody a piece of bread with that. Right? He says there's no way to feed these people. He looks at the problem, forgets who Jesus is, and all he can see is we don't have enough. Andrew's answer is so much better. It may seem only a little bit different, but it's so much better. Andrew remembers who Jesus is. Andrew brings what they have. And Andrew can do math too. Now Philip knows they don't have enough. Andrew knows they don't have enough. He says, "But we've got this. What could Jesus do with this?" And that makes all the difference in the world. Today, I want you to look at Jesus Christ and ask yourself which response you're giving to him and which the sign of bread calls you to make. One response is very practical, but ultimately faithless. When we look at the world and see only what I can do and assume that's as much as God can do, well, then that's about as far as we could get. We don't have enough, and we never will. There will never be enough for us to be the people that we need to be in this life when we exclude God from the equation. There's never enough. But the better answer is to say, "Well, I've got this. If I were to give even this little bit that I've got to God, what could he do with it?" Your life is very small. The universe is very big. The problems that our world faces are enormous. We watch the news and we think, "What could I possibly do about that?" And the answer is, you don't have enough. But you've got something. And if you were to give even that unto God, God is capable of doing so much more than what we ask or what we think. Take a moment and consider your life. See what you have to offer Christ Jesus. It's not enough, but he is, because he's the God that provides bread, and he's the God who walks upon the sea. And if you've not given all that you are and all that you have to him, we're going to stand and sing a word of encouragement at this time, and we encourage you to come today.